Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. And we're going to be starting our program today by talking with you about ACL injuries. You know, there's, what, 100 to 200,000 of them every year in the U.S. And so we'll talk about surgical, non-surgical treatment. We'll talk about prevention of ACL injuries with our two guests, Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, Lori Tyne-Brody. Jill, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. Jill, good to have you back.
It's great to be here, especially since it's air conditioned in here. It's
yes.
Pretty warm out.
Lori with us as well. Lori Tyne-Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Lori, good to see you again.
It is great to be here.
And we'll talk about ACL injury and other things as well, but maybe you've had treatment for an ACL injury. What physical therapy questions do you have? I hope you'll join in. Give a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's the number. You can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Lori, let me turn to you first. We're going to be this whole business about ACL injuries. How do they normally occur?
Mm-hmm. Well, the anterior cruciate ligament is one of the key ligaments that provides stability to your knee. Most of us have seen an athlete go down at one time or another clutching his or her knee, only to later learn that they have torn their ACL, and a collective sigh occurs
right
at that time because they are difficult injuries to treat.
Most of them occur, though, interestingly, non-contact. So even if they're playing a collision-type sport, such as football, it's usually due to a plant and a twist. It's not necessarily due to collision with another athlete.
Exactly. And there's a very high prevalence of ACL injuries in female athletes. So one of the questions that we are posed often is, should I have surgery to reconstruct this or not? The surgical techniques have advanced tremendously over the last 20, 25 years, as had their rehabilitation. And so there are also many people who are quite successful without having surgery, and the medical community has been scratching their heads trying to figure out why some people do well and others do not do well without surgery. And so there was an article that came out recently trying to tease out more of those variables. And they looked at some tests that we commonly use when we see patients with knee injuries, standardized tools, and many of you who have gone to see a physical therapist have probably filled out questionnaires when you arrived, and that's what these tools are. So the International Knee Documentation Society has a tool, as well as the Knee Outcome Survey, and that's broken into a sports and an ADL subscore. In any case, they did a study in Norway looking at a group of athletes who chose not to have surgery, and they looked at some of their measures when they first came in, and then they looked at them 2 years later. About a number of them actually went on to have surgery because they did not do well with non-surgical treatment. Of the things that were predictive of success without surgery after a couple years were the baseline knee outcome score, as well as the quadriceps test score, so testing via single leg jump and a quadriceps symmetry index, they call it.
Yeah.
Additionally, being older and female was associated with success with non-surgical treatment.
Yeah. So the part of the question is, you know, first of all, the tool that predicts this, the outcome tool, is very important. So when you go, if you are a patient, you're going to a clinic, fill it out very, very honestly. That's very important. But the other question is, did these women who are a little older have a successful outcome because they modified their lifestyle?
Exactly.
So that's something that people end up doing. Well, I used to downhill ski and now I don't. Or I used to play recreational soccer with my friends and now I've modified that activity. So the question you always have to ask is, what changes did these people undergo to make it successful? Perhaps some of them didn't do any lifestyle changes, but perhaps some of them did. And those tools don't always pull those things out, which makes it challenging.
Well, and specifically this tool, the knee outcome score, used the ADL score, which is your activities of daily living, which are, can you climb the stairs? Can you get in and out of a chair? Things like that. They didn't use the sports score, which may have yielded different results. You may have then discovered that some of these people actually gave up their sports.
Right. Yeah. So for those who showed improvement, then the older women did better than the younger women.
Right, exactly. So the statistic they provided, or the example, was that if you were a woman who was over 30 and had a score of 90 on the knee outcome score and a limb symmetry index of 90% or above early after your injury, you had an 85% probability of a successful non-surgical outcome 2 years later. In contrast, the same woman who scored 65 on the knee outcome score and a limb symmetry index below 90% would only have a 29% probability of success after 2 years. So they found that these tools measured soon after their injury were quite predictive of who would do well.
And the nice thing about these tools is they're very easy for a physical therapist to implement. They don't require a lot of equipment. And so it's something that all physical therapists can quite easily use. Mm-hmm.
So that really helps in making a decision as to whether or not you're going to do surgery.
It does.
Correct.
It does. And that's a question that many patients have is, do I need to have surgery? Do I have to have surgery? Can I wait? Does it need to be done now? Those are many, many questions that we face. On the other side of the coin is...
I thought we've already covered two sides. Do you have another side?
A third side.
Yeah, we did. Oh, boy. The other idea, the other concept is there any way we can prevent these from happening in the first place?
Yeah.
So we know that people who tear their ACL, regardless of whether they have surgery or not, 8 to 10 years after the injury, show early signs of osteoarthritis radiographically. So if you look at an x-ray of somebody who's torn their ACL 8 to 10 years down the road, they're already showing arthritic changes. And so we'd love to prevent these ACLs from happening in the first place. And so there are many prevention programs or performance training programs out there that are geared towards kind of the younger population who are really at the greatest risk for tearing their ACL. The highest percentage of females who tear their ACL is between the ages of 14 and 18, which is the high
right
school.
Right in Emily's, my daughter.
Right in, it's the high school female athlete. Mm-hmm. The males are a little bit older, but not much. And so the question becomes, is there something we can do with this population, or perhaps even a younger population, to prevent the ACL injury from happening in the first place? And there's a new term that's kind of come out that really kind of addresses this concept, and it's called physical literacy. And by definition, it's the ability, confidence, and desire to be physically active for life. So it's really instilling in the adolescent and high school population how to remain physically active throughout their life and teaching them or showing them different movement patterns. Historically, when Lori was first practicing as a physical therapist, because she's older than I am, she probably remembers when strength training and resistance training for the adolescent and high school athlete was really kind of shunned upon, and people were kind of against it because they were very concerned about growth plates and injuries and things like that. Then the pendulum kind of swung towards the middle and saying, you know what? Resistance training is okay as long as it's supervised and there's proper form. Now, the International Olympic Committee and the National Strength and Conditioning Association both strongly support regular participation in resistance training as a means of reducing sports-related injury risk and improving physical literacy among our youth. When we say resistance training, we do not mean that they are lifting heavy weights. What we mean is they're using their body as resistance, and they're learning motor programs that have proper form and technique and proper movement patterns in hopes to prevent an injury, including an injury to the anterior cruciate ligament.
Perfect.
So my daughter's resistance training, weight training, and all that during the summer here,
right.
goes a few times a week for
yep.
that. It's a good thing.
It's yep. fabulous. It's fabulous for all activities. And I know Emily is in band.
Yeah.
And people don't think that band members are athletes, but I will tell you very differently, and I know you'd agree with me, Larry, and I know she's percussion, so she carries a load,
yep.
and they're moving in all different planes and directions, and so the balance and the coordination, all of that can be trained through these type of programs, so it's ideal that Emily's doing something like
right.
that. And I know she plays sports, too, but I think sometimes we forget, we don't think about band as a sport or being physically active, and it is.
And I think one of the important points that you made is that it's not just being on a weight machine and lifting right. weights, but it's really important to learn the motor programs involving stability and mobility and body awareness, spatial awareness.
Mm-hmm. That's really the nuts and bolts of it.
Well, let's take some calls. By the way, you can join in with your question at 1-800-642-1234. James in Green Bay up first here. Hi, James. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and girls. Thanks a lot. For the program, I had an ACL surgery 38 years ago, so it was one of the earlier ones. I was in a cast for almost 3 months.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember that.
Yeah. I can't straighten my leg. Haven't been able to straighten my leg all the way. And, of course, now it hurts.
Right.
You said, you just said, roughly 10 years after, you know, arthritic symptoms start creeping in. I'm going to have my knee replaced, I'm sure. I'm 67, almost 68. When I have that done, mm-hmm. if and when, will they be able to straighten my leg out so I can walk normally versus this kind of limp I have?
Boy, that's a great question. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to let our listeners know that you were 38 years ago, people were casted when they had their ACL reconstructed, and they were casted with their knee in a little bit of flexion. And it was awful. And how the pendulum swung to teach us that we shouldn't be casting people and we should get their knee fully straight right away is there were people who had casts on who were so frustrated they went in their bathtub and they soaked off their casts and cut their casts off themselves and got their knee straight, and they had a better outcome than someone like James.
Boy.
Yeah. So people like that changed how we did rehab. But that's a great question, and part of it will be looking at the soft tissue structures behind your knee that have become shortened and remodeled to this kind of shortened length.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that probably only the surgeon
right.
can answer and may or may not even know till he or she gets in there.
Right.
He can bring it up with them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you may want to talk to them now and say, is there any benefit to doing it now? Is there a greater chance my knee will go straight than if I wait, depending upon how your knee looks at this point in time?
Yeah.
But the other thing to keep in mind is, you know, you've been walking around with a bent knee, altered gait pattern, and a shortened leg. So you probably have some changes that are happening. You are placing yourself at risk for other problems, hip, ankle, low back, because of that altered gait and that leg length difference. So just keep in mind that the longer you wait, you may start to see these other things manifest.
Oh, there you go. Good luck, James. Thank you so much for calling. Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guests today from the University of Wisconsin. Lori, physical therapist, athletic trainer. Jill, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at all kinds of physical therapy issues, but zeroing in a bit on ACL injuries. Larry Mueller here with my guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. All our lines are filled, so we'll go right back to the phones here and to Philip in Trempealeau. Philip, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I didn't hear the previous caller, but I think I have a similar situation. I was 16 when I had my ACL torn in a lacrosse injury when I was playing lacrosse in high school. And they chose not to repair it, I guess because it was so torn. And back then, they didn't really have any techniques to fix it. So I just rehabbed with a really good physical therapist. And then went back to playing lacrosse. And actually went into the Army. They accepted my condition because I had strengthened that so well and given the knee so much support.
Good for you.
I don't even know how many marathons I've done and a couple of Ironmen. And it's just, I've been one of those things where you have to, every day you have to work on it and make sure that it stays strong and balanced. And I just wanted to point that out. If people decide not to have their surgery, it's a lot of work, but it's worth it.
All right.
Wow, that's a great story.
I'm so glad
that you called in, because people do have that belief that, oh, I tore my ACL, I need to get it fixed. And in general, they don't repair them. They are very difficult to repair. The repair generally does not hold. They've tried a variety of different techniques, and they're continuing to try different techniques to repair them. Generally, what you have done is a reconstruction where they take other tissue, either from your patellar tendon or your hamstring tendon, and they make a new ACL out of that tendon. But there is, roughly, the statistics would say, about 33% of people who non-surgically do very well. And Philip's a great case for that. He didn't quit being active.
Right.
He played lacrosse, a very active sport that requires starting, stopping, cutting, all the things that challenge the ACL. And he's been successful. But you make the perfect point of ongoing rehab.
Right, and he keeps his legs strong. Mm-hmm. I mean, he said that he's very diligent about doing strengthening exercises, which is really, really important.
And goes back to your point about physical literacy, and that is activity across your lifetime. It's so important.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Philip, for calling. Appreciate it. Christopher in Madison, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Christopher.
Hello. About a week ago, I tore the bottom of my foot, so I have very intense heel pain on my right foot, right beneath the heel. Is that plantar fasciitis? What do I do?
How do you feel? You felt a tearing sensation, Christopher?
Well, just a sudden, sharp, stabbing, sharp pain right there at the bottom of the heel.
Okay, what were you doing when that happened?
Oh, carrying a heavy window.
Oh.
Okay.
Do you have any bleeding or discoloration,
no,
or does that foot look flatter than the other one?
Nope.
Can you go up on your toes, and do you still see an arch in your foot when you go up on your toes? Do you look the same?
Yes.
Okay.
Good.
All right, good. So, you may have given yourself an acute plantar fasciitis. And if it doesn't settle down in the next week to 10 days, and I'm saying it's not going to be completely better, but you should be on an improvement trajectory, then you should go in and have it seen. Most plantar fasciitis has a gradual onset. We don't see acute plantar fasciitis very often. But you should be wearing good supportive shoes, wear something with an arch support. You should be icing several times a day to calm down the inflammation there. And I'd probably get in and see somebody, mm-hmm, and have it looked at, see a physical therapist, have them examine your foot, look at your strength, look at the mobility of your fascia, look for tender points, and kind of guide you through a rehab process.
Right. The reason Lori asked all those other questions about his flat-footedness and can he go up on his toes is because there are other tendons or ligaments that you can tear in your foot that can have a much worse outcome. So that was part of the issue.
There you go, Christopher. Thank you for calling. Tom in Madison, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Well, thank you for taking my call, Larry.
Sure.
On Friday afternoon, I was golfing up in northern Michigan on a rainy day.
Yeah. Did you have a sailboat with you? I heard that it's really wet up there, isn't it?
I could have used one, but the course had dried out to a certain extent. Anyway, taking a full swing, my left foot slipped on the grass slightly, and in my left knee, I heard a pop. And I have torn my hamstring before, and it was the exact same sound. And then my knee buckled, and I had to immediately go home, and I put it on ice. And I'm just wondering if that was an ACL type of injury. It's already Monday and I feel much better, so there's no bruising. I just wondered what might have been that popping sound.
Right. Well, that's a great question. Did you notice after that popping sound, Tom, did you have a huge swollen knee? Did it blow up like a balloon?
No, and that's what was very surprising. No very little, just a slight brownish bruise and very little swelling at all.
Where was
I did get it on? I got it on ice right away.
Good. Where was the bruise? Was it on the inside of your knee or the outside of your knee?
On the outside of my knee.
Okay, good. So it's very common when someone tears their ACL to have that audible pop, but typically with it we see an immediate effusion, a huge swollen knee right away. So it's encouraging that you didn't have a big swollen knee.
Is your knee wobbly at all when you walk around on it? Does it feel unstable or wobbly at all?
Today it's felt great, and I think the only thing where I feel a little bit of pain or wobbly is... Mm-hmm. is going side-to-side motion, not front or back.
Okay. Can you do a golf swing? Would you be able to swing a club and twist on your knee and it would feel okay, or do you feel it would be wobbly with a twist?
It's painful. I attempted it yesterday, and it was kind of painful, so I stopped trying.
Yeah,
there's a golfer for you. I tested it yesterday.
Well, we're sorting it out. So the prime suspects here are a meniscus tear, which will swell slowly over time.
Right.
So if you get an immediate swelling, we think ACL because you tear the ligament and it swells right away. Now, the other possibility is that you already had a partial ACL tear in your past and you just finished it off so there was no bleeding. Mm-hmm. Then you could have torn your meniscus, but typically you would get an effusion 12 to 20 hours later. You could have also sprained a ligament like your MCL. If it was on the inside, it was on the mm-hmm. outside, your lateral collateral ligament, right. One of your collateral ligaments as well. So, I'd probably go in and have it looked at, have someone examine your knee and give you some, try to figure out what is the culprit so that we can get you back on the golf course.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
I'm glad it's feeling better. That's good. But you would hate to go back out and re-injure it or so.
Yeah,
I agree.
Can they look at an MRI or something, show where the damage is or...
Yes.
It would show up on an MRI.
It would show up on an MRI, but a good clinical exam can get you probably 80% of the way there.
Right.
Okay.
And then typically you would go through a rehab program because unless you're going to have surgery, the MRI is just a nice add-on to confirm your clinical suspicion. So it's better to start off with a good clinical exam and go through rehab. And then if you're really thinking, this is not working, I'm not getting back to what I need to do, I need more information because I'm thinking about another level of intervention, then you go to an MRI.
Right.
Tom, thanks. Good luck. Appreciate the call. Hope you get back out on the course quickly. I would hate to have that right now myself at this time of the year.
Exactly.
Oh, Amy and Iola, your turn. Hi, Amy.
Hi. My son tore broke his femur in half 3 years ago, and it was put back together at a 15-degree difference, and now it's increased to 23 degrees. And when we came to Madison, they said that he should have it repaired. And I wonder if he should have that done sooner than later, or...
Those are great...
And what it means.
Those are great questions.
What is that repair?
So how old was he when this happened? So he fractured his femur 3 years ago. How old was he at the time?
24.
So he was 24 years old, and he has a 15-degree angle in his femur?
Yeah, well, his foot is turned 15 degrees, and now it's increased to 23. And he says the measurement is being done the same way.
Right,
time.
Yeah. So it's when his femur, it's healed with a twist, it sounds like. It's twisted?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it was put back together with a twist.
Right,
a twist,
okay. Right.
And so they're looking at refracturing it and realigning it and letting it heal. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, that's what I'm asking about.
Yeah.
It was a doctor in Madison that recommended that he have it repaired.
Yeah.
For the long-term health of his leg, because it's progressively increasing potentially, I would probably go with that doctor's advice.
Right. And part of it is because, number one, in 3 years you've seen a pretty good increase in the torsion or the twist. And number two, that will affect the knee, the foot, the toes, the back, the hip. It'll affect all those joints. And your son is 24. He's very young. And mm-hmm. so to live with that and have it potentially get progressively worse over many, many years, it could end up being very debilitating. Mm-hmm. So typically, my best guess is what they'd do is they'd go back in at the fracture site and they'd refracture it, meaning they'd use a device to basically saw it and they'd re-rotate it. And then my guess is probably pin it or mm-hmm. screw it into plate an alignment it. Plate it. Yeah.
Mm. There you go, mm-hmm. Amy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sooner than later.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Ellen in La Crosse, it's your turn. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I hurt my knee about 3 weeks ago at a vigorous exercise class that I go to regularly. I saw a physical therapist after the initial injury, and my knee has settled down. My structure and function of my knee is fine, but the injury is actually my soleus and gastroc muscle
yep.
is what was described. And the pain is really focused on the left side kind of my calf, high up towards my knee.
On the outside?
Yes.
Okay.
He treated me with dry needling
yep.
and stimulated that muscle. Yep. And then I have exercises that I've been doing to stretch it out. And I've been very diligent. I went back and I had improved flexion. I initially had some limitations, like with flexion and getting my leg all the way straight. That has improved, but that pain is still there, just really localized in that muscle, despite
yeah.
all my exercises. Is it going to just continue to get better, or is there something else I should be asking him about?
Those are great questions. And so... the gastroc and the soleus muscle is a, what we call a postural muscle. So it lies very deep to the gastroc, deep to the calf muscle. And those postural muscles are slow twitch fibers, and we use them all day long with standing, walking, going from sit to stand, reaching in our cupboard. And so as a consequence, they don't get a lot of rest. And so it does take longer for them to heal. So it sounds like you're on a good upward trajectory. I think it will probably just take a little bit more time, but everything you're describing sounds like you're on a good path.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Yeah, and as Jill said, that soleus is a postural muscle. Additionally, the gastroc, the other muscle, you use every time you take a step.
Yeah.
So you use it for push-off. It gets stretched at the end of your gait cycle. It's under a long stretch, so it gets worked all day long. So it just takes a little bit longer for those to heal. So just stay in touch with your physical therapist and make sure the two of you are in conversation mm-hmm. about it and that you're both satisfied with the progress you're making.
Yep.
Yep.
And that's how I would have treated it, too.
Good luck, Ellen. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Steve in Kewaunee, Illinois, next. Thanks, Steve, for calling.
Kewaunee, Wisconsin.
Oh.
Great timing, great show. Thanks, guys. Thanks for the call. This funny thing happened to me last night. I'm sitting in a pretty nice desk chair, leaning in against the, you know, doing computer stuff. And I get this, like, electric shock laterally below the kneecap. It's like somebody took some duct tape and pulled it off.
Mm.
And that's happened before, and it doesn't hurt. And I'm just curious, what?
What's going on there?
What is that?
That's a great question. Does it always happen when you're seated?
Well, probably. It doesn't always happen. This is
right.
a rare thing.
Okay.
But that's what I can recall.
Okay.
It only happened a couple times.
Okay. All right. And did you feel like your lower leg was twisted in a certain position or anything like
well,
that?
Oh, no. I don't know. No.
Okay. All right. And
it could very well be a different position, but, you know, it's like, you know, the right foot is forward, the left foot
sure.
is, or no,
sure.
the right foot is, say, under the edge of the chair, left foot is forward, or, you know.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, you know, my best guess is that you're sitting right on your sciatic nerve.
Yeah.
And it may be just a little weight shift, or you've been on it a little bit too long, and you get a little zing of sciatica, like almost like when you hit your funny bone. You know, on something and you get that zing in your arm, it's possible you're getting the same thing from sitting on your sciatic nerve.
Sitting on your billfold, maybe?
Sitting on your
right.
billfold, yep.
Exactly.
Yep, that's another great
or
suggestion.
Or if you're mousing and you're leaning that way a little bit and perhaps shifting your weight more onto that buttock, that could be
yeah.
a factor.
Yeah.
So
that's my best guess.
Yeah.
There's in terms of the outside of your knee, there's not much else there that would cause that kind of an electrical sensation.
Right. Hmm.
There we go. Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. And Ernest in Stanley, it's your turn. Hi, Ernest.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for letting me on. I'll just make a short comment. I injured my knee in 66 and I couldn't get it healed, but I had rode a bicycle a long time before that. But, you know, I was my 25-year-old, about 24. So then I went back to riding my bicycle, and my knee healed in a couple months. So bicycle riding is probably, you know, through actual testing, is one of the best ways to get good circulation and strengthen your legs and your knees and stuff like that, and it lasts you a lifetime.
We couldn't agree with you
exactly.
more.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely.
We are in, well, I guess next month, we're riding our bike across the great state of Iowa again. I don't know how many years this is for us, but we bike from the Missouri River to the Mississippi.
Right. And the average, it's on any given day, it's about 10,000 riders. But the interesting thing is, with the demographics, the average rider is a 55-year-old male.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It is a lifetime sport. It's great for your knees. It promotes circulation, like Ernest said. It's not on impact.
Yep.
It's a great, great activity.
And there's all kinds of bikes. So it's
right.
It's not, you're not just like bent over like the speed bicyclist there. There are upright bikes. There are recumbent bikes. There are three-wheeled trikes. We see everything on this bike ride across Iowa, Ragbri.
Including a unicycle.
Including a unicycle, yes. A couple of unicyclers.
Yep.
And a couple people skateboard.
Yep.
And an elliptigo.
Yep. And we've seen tandem recumbent bikes.
Yes.
We've seen regular tandems.
My favorite was the family of six that were all strung together. So it was mom, dad, and then like a bunch of kids all strung
right.
along on a huge, I think it was a triple followed by three sort
like
of tag-alongs.
Yeah,
something like that. So,
I mean,
yeah.
That's a great example of physical literacy, teaching your family, you know, the whole lifestyle of being active throughout your life. So thank you so much, Ernest, for that comment.
Yep.
We couldn't agree with you more.
Yep.
I jumped on the bike this Saturday morning. I thought I was just right around Lake Monona.
And it's a beautiful
nice.
Ride.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful ride, 13 miles,
yep,
is over
yep,
quick.
It's perfect.
But it was a great little exercise.
Yeah, it's over quick unless you stop at that bait and tackle shop where you can get ice cream and worms at the same time.
I don't go by that one.
Oh.
I avoid that
oh,
because
you're smart.
The ice cream
you're
is...
You're smart.
Oh. Yeah. Ernest, thanks a lot. Appreciate the call. Oh, my goodness. Let's go to Charlie in Fish Creek. Hi, Charlie.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I've been to see an orthopedic guy, and he told me that I'm going to soon have knee replacement surgery. About 38 years ago, I had my medial meniscus removed.
Mm.
And
oh.
So I've been bone on bone since, and it's worked great, you know. But when I went in, he also told me that I had a torn ACL.
Oh,
And that's been torn for about 20 years. So my question is, and he said something about when they do the knee replacement surgery, that the ACL would be hooked back up again. I was just wondering if you could speak on that a little bit.
Sure. There are numerous different, when somebody has their knee replaced, there are numerous different companies that make different components where you replace your knee. So if you have a full knee replacement, a total knee replacement, you typically get the distal end of the femur and the tibia plateau, and then you get a little button on the underside of your patella. Some of those knee replacement devices are what we call cruciate sparing. In other words, they keep your cruciates and you can rotate around them. Others remove your cruciates and you don't need cruciates for those. Surgeons usually have preferences for which devices they choose to implant in patients. So it's a lot of times up to them regarding the size of the components, what brands they like best, things like that. So a knee replacement isn't the same as a knee replacement. The devices that they implant in your knee can be very different.
Right. So he is not going to reconstruct your ACL, but he's going to choose components that will stabilize like you had an ACL.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. There we go. And then some of the new knee replacement, I mean, there are some that are sort of standardized sizes, and then there are some new ones out where you are fitted to your exact...
Right. So the makoplasties in particular, the robotic ones that people are having, which are unicompartmental, which only fix one part of the knee, so it's not a total knee replacement, it's a unicompartmental replacement. Mm-hmm. Those are very customized and fit because they're only replacing half, so you have to make sure it fits perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Charlie. Good luck. Appreciate the call. And Mike in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Yes, quick little story involving both my wife and myself. Mm-hmm. I had an MRI done on my shoulder. I injured it, and they said I should have a rotator cuff surgery, and that was tentatively scheduled for a number of months out. But in the meantime, my wife took a very severe fall over in Europe coming down the steps, and she literally couldn't move her right shoulder at all. So we got back to the States, and her physician immediately moved her to the top of the list for surgery, and very successful surgery, I might add.
Did she have a rotator cuff repair, Mike?
She did, yes.
Okay, all right.
But having seen her recovery, the amount of pain, the time that it took.
Yes.
And I still have good range of motion. I just have no strength. So I'm strongly considering not doing it. I just wanted to get your thoughts on the subject.
I love that story.
Right, I do too. Guys, I saw what that's my wife had to do, and I'm not doing that.
That's the yin and the yang
exactly.
of this. Yeah.
Exactly. So it's very important that you have good range of motion. That is critical. That is fabulous. Have you seen a physical therapist to get on a strengthening program?
I have not.
Oh.
She is doing therapy, still recovering from her surgery, which was like a year ago.
Okay.
And she does intermittent therapy.
So there's a difference between an acute rotator cuff tear and a degenerative chronic rotator cuff tear. So acute tears, they're more likely to repair because you have a fresh tear, so to speak. Degenerative tears, the surgeons say, are like sewing spaghetti back together. So they don't always repair those. They need to have good quality tissue to actually repair. When they do MRIs of people across the lifespan, you will find that most people in their 60s, 70s, 80s have various levels of rotator cuff tears, and most people function very well. But as Jill said, you really need to have good range of motion, and depending upon which of your rotator cuff muscles are torn and how badly and how long it's been, some of the other muscles can accommodate for your rotator cuff.
Yeah, if I were you, I would try a really good strengthening program. So I would perhaps see the physical therapist that your wife is seeing for an individualized program. I wouldn't just necessarily do what your wife is doing, and I know that's easy to do. I would do that. And only if you really have failed that would I consider surgery. And if pain and weakness are your main complaints, first of all, if you get stronger and you still have pain, I wouldn't necessarily suggest a cuff repair as much as I'd suggest a debridement, where they just go in and clean up the scar tissue, because many times that's the pain generator.
Oh, there we go.
So and the recovery from that would be much, much better. Mm-hmm. So it's very easy to recover from that versus what your wife is going through with an acute cuff tear.
Right.
I flashed on an old memory while he was talking, because my mother was in the hospital for some surgery, and I had appendicitis attack.
Oh, no.
And so the doctor came to my mother and said, would you like to see your son before he goes into surgery?
Oh, my goodness. Did they put you in the same room afterwards?
No, they Oh, boy. Well, I tell you what, we are talking all kinds of things here, about all kinds of things here, ACL injuries and other physical therapy issues, with our two guests, Lori Tyne-Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Dave Potratz, our engineer, here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at all kinds of physical therapy issues today with our two guests, Lori Tyne-Brody, Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, Larry Mueller here. We'll go back to the phones and John in Fitchburg up next. Hi, John.
Hey, yes, I had a quick question here. I had an ACL tear on my right knee about 7 to 8 years ago. They took my hamstring tendon, and I had a double bundle reconstruction. Right away, it was good, knee was strong. And over time, though, on the inside of my knee, there's a tendon that's gotten very tight, and I'm not able to straighten my knee out. I know you, earlier in the program, you had mentioned that in 8 to 10 years, osteoarthritis starts to kick in, and I'm just wondering if things are getting tight and not working the way that they should. I mean, is that kind of a sign of worse things to come down the road, and if there's anything I can do about it now?
Those are great questions. So when they take, just for our listeners, when they take a hamstring graft, an autograft, they do take it from the hamstring on the inside of your knee, like you're talking about. So can you, when you try and straighten your knee, does it feel like a bony stop, or does it feel kind of springy, like you're stretching a muscle, or what does it feel like if you try and push and straighten out your knee all the way?
If I try and straighten it out all the way, I mean, I can feel it on the inside of my knee a little bit.
Okay.
The other things that you mentioned, not really. It's just, even if it feels fluid and I don't have any like feeling, it just doesn't go as far as it did before.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you need to get back into physical therapy now before this gets any worse. One of the most devastating things for the long-term health of your knee is the loss of extension.
Right.
And it starts a whole cascade of issues with loss of patellar mobility, loss of quadriceps strength, altered gait, hip. I mean,
back pain.
Right, a whole list of things. So for some reason, and it may be related to scar in that hamstring tendon where they took the graft, you need to get that moving. You need to be able to get your knee straight. So I would get myself, do not pass go, do not collect $200, back into physical therapy and have them take a look at that and get you going so you can get that knee straight.
Yep. There you go. Go for it, John. Thanks for calling. Matt in Boston, Massachusetts, your turn. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure, thanks for calling.
I have a question about my ankle, and it's really stiff, it's sore, it reminds me of a stress fracture. I have injured the ankle twice in my younger days, and I had it x-rayed several months ago. They didn't say anything's broken, they didn't see any damage, but it still feels swollen. It still feels like a stress fracture at night after a long day. I may limp a little bit. And it started, I would say, last summer, about a year ago. I thought it was because I got a new vehicle where the gas pedal was a little harder to push, but it hasn't gone away. And I'm wondering if you have any ideas on what it might be, what might be causing it, or what I can do to improve it.
Yeah.
So what were the ankle injuries when you were younger?
So I did have a stress fracture when I was younger, and then another injury was, I don't know what the injury is called, but it's where your foot kind of extends forward a bit too much. I had an air cast for that one, where your foot extends forward a little too much.
Your foot extends forward too much.
Yeah, like a ballet dancer when they point their toes.
Plantar flexes?
Perhaps.
Okay.
It was.
Okay. Are you hypermobile?
I don't believe so.
Okay. All right. Where was your stress fracture?
The stress fracture was in the ankle. I would say closer, it was about halfway, but a little closer towards the actual joint.
So on the shin bone?
Yeah.
Okay. Are you a runner?
I used to run a lot.
Okay.
I still enjoy running, but it actually feels a little better from running.
So is the pain in the same area on the lower shin bone, or is it down in your ankle joint itself?
It feels like it's that entire area. It feels like it's on the shin for sure. It feels swollen, stiff, but it feels like it carries into the bone, into the joint a little bit. And in a way, I look at my two legs, and this particular one looks a little different, almost as though the actual arch it's a little flatter, so the joint maybe bends a little bit more than the other side, if that makes sense.
So yeah. When you go up on your toes, does your arch go in equally on both sides?
When I go up on my toes, it looks the same on both sides.
Okay.
Because
it's only when I go down and I'm flat on my feet that it looks a little different.
Okay. All right. Are you active now? Are you running now? Are you...
At the moment, I'm not running very much, mainly just walking, regular activity throughout the day. I'm not sitting all day. It's a mix of everything, but nothing intense like running.
Okay.
To me, it sounds like something deep in your ankle joint itself. So it can refer or radiate sort of up into your shin and down into your foot, almost like a Taylor dome
right.
kind of issue. So when you go down and flat and your foot flattens out a little bit, you get a little bit of rotation of that Taylor dome. And then your whole talk about your foot going down too far, it tells me that there's something with the mortise and the Taylor dome that doesn't sound right. An X-ray won't show necessarily something
right.
like an osteochondral defect
right.
that we've been discussing. It won't
right.
show that. It only shows like the grossest
occult
fracture.
Right.
Right, exactly.
So what I would do is I think you should try a course of physical therapy to see if you're really stiff there or hypomobile, if some joint mobilization or stretching, flexibility, strengthening can improve it. And if with that you're not turning the corner in 4 to 6 weeks, I think I would go down the path of getting an MRI to see what else is going on in that ankle joint.
Or a CT scan.
Yeah.
I would see a foot and ankle specialist, though. I wouldn't
right.
go to a general physician or necessarily even an orthopedic who does hips or spine. I'd go to someone who specializes in foot and ankle, because this is not your garden variety X, Y, or Z.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There you go. Good luck, Matt. Thanks very much for calling. And Lori in Madison, it's your turn next. Hi, Lori.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Hi. I'd like to ask a question about advice on having or not having bunion surgery and whether there's a physical therapy alternative.
Oh, that's a great question. So bunions, which usually protrude out the by your big toe, out the inside of your foot. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. I have fairly severe bunion, which I know to
right.
be dramatic. And I
right.
should mention I'm older. I'm 62.
That's not older.
That's not old.
Just for the record.
Yeah. This Lori is telling you it's not old.
In any case.
Do the surgery, but I have no pain.
Okay. Oh. All right. So, yeah. I probably wouldn't get it done if you're not having pain.
Right.
Because what can physical therapy do? Physical therapy will look at your foot mechanics and see why the bunion is there. So the bunion is basically your body laying down more bone because that joint is seeing more stress. It's the same theory as a heel spur. When you're flat-footed and your plantar fascia gets tugged on, your heel produces more bone. When you walk and generally have flat feet or altered excessive pronation, you put more load on that joint by your big toe, so your big toe makes more bone. There's no problem with that extra bone there unless it hurts.
Right.
So, but if you want to potentially stop the progression of it, you could see a physical therapist who would look at your foot mechanics and see what they could suggest for you in terms of altering your foot posture and the mechanics of how your foot works so it can offload that joint.
And shoe wear recommendations, because
yeah.
I know it's my daughter has bunions, too. And I know it's difficult. Sometimes she needs shoes with a very wide toe box, because if she gets narrow shoes, it's painful for her.
Mm.
And so, one or two visits with a physical therapist could help with it. But as long as they're not painful, I would not have the surgery. The postoperative care after the surgery is very demanding. It's long. It's a lot of work on the patient's part.
The other thing that we tend to see with people who have bunions is they develop the bunions because when they walk, they roll off the inside of their foot instead of out the end of their big toe. So they tend to lose motion at that joint right where that bunion is. And it'd be really important to maintain as much motion as you can there, or else you'll never be able to get away from that rolling off the inside of your foot. So they can teach you how to keep that joint mobile.
There you go. Thank you so much, Lori. Christina in Glenwood City, your turn. Hi, Christina.
Thank you. My son is currently in surgery right now. He was kicked in the arm by a horse. It dislocated his elbow, and he got a complete break between the elbow and his wrist. I'm wondering if you can advise us about how to manage that as he heals, and then following it, what types of physical therapy he should have.
Absolutely. How old is your son?
He's 40 years old.
Okay. All right. So he will be immobilized afterwards for quite some time. The nice thing is the elbow joint is a very stable joint, so his risk of dislocating it again is very, very low. But having said that, it is a joint that has a tendency to get stiff very quickly. So once the physician feels the fracture is stable, he or she will refer your son to physical therapy to start doing elbow range of motion and some forearm range of motion. So the physician will kind of guide or steer when physical therapy can start, or occupational therapy as well. I would encourage you to see somebody who specializes in the upper quarter, but the main thing will be just following those guidelines.
And stick to them.
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah, that's always a big issue. Well, he's in surgery right now. Christina, good luck with his surgery. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Well, talking all kinds of physical therapy issues today with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW's Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Also with us today, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. And they're going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. You'll be able to join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, and we'll take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back. You stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at all kinds of physical therapy issues today with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Lori, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW's Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. All of our lines are filled. The number is 800-642-1234. Let's go to Christine in Franklin, who's been waiting a bit. Christine, thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have problems with my spine for many years. But recently in January, I was in a car accident, and I do have stage one modic changes, and three of my vertebrae are moving on flexing x-rays. It gets a little worse on one, and three of them are flattening on my spinal cord. I have late stage Lyme disease. Can physical therapy help me?
So when you say your spine is flattening, so the imaging shows that there is pressure on your spinal cord itself. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you had mentioned they had done x-ray, flexion extension x-rays. So when you flexed forward, they noticed that some of your segments were sliding forward. Is that what you were saying?
Well, there's antrolisthesis.
I was going to say, yeah, she's got an antrolisthesis.
Okay.
So that kind of a shift.
Okay.
So can physical therapy help you? Yes. Is it going to change the antrolisthesis? No. But what we do know is that teaching you strengthening and stabilization exercises and improving your core strength can help you stabilize your spine and prevent worsening of your symptoms. So are you talking about surgery? Are they talking about surgery for you?
I am still in that process, but I also have retrolisthesis.
Right, retrolisthesis. Yeah. So an antrolisthesis is a forward slippage of one vertebrae on another, and a retrolisthesis is a backwards. So some of it depends upon how severe your symptoms are. So if you're getting pressure on your spinal cord itself, that's not sciatica. Sciatica is different, but pressure on your spinal cord will typically give you symptoms into both legs.
It can affect your bowel and bladder. You can have loss of sensation. We call their saddle area, or in your genital area where you would sit on a saddle. So they call it the saddle area. So if you're noticing progressive symptoms in your legs, if you're noticing tripping or loss of sensation in your legs, stumbling, falling down, or the saddle anesthesia or progressive bowel and bladder, those are emergency situations and you need to be seen. So I'm glad you're in the medical system and you're being monitored. Before I went to surgery, I would certainly see a physical therapist because you will need rehabilitation after. And so starting some exercise before, so that if you do end up going to surgery, you are stronger when you come out.
Right.
Yeah, makes
exactly.
good sense.
Yeah.
Good luck, Christine. Thank you so much for calling. Maury in Madison, your turn. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thanks, Larry. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
I was just a couple weeks ago diagnosed with thoracic outlet syndrome. Mm-hmm. And I've had symptoms it's been kind of progressive for many years. And it's all neuropathic. It's not vascular at all.
Good. Neurogenic.
Neurogenic. I just started physical therapy. I've been going for a couple weeks and doing my exercises. But I've gotten mixed reactions from coworkers. I'm a nurse, so and stopped a couple of orthopedic residents and asked their opinion. And so I've gotten a lot of mixed reactions.
Right.
And there's also been mention of the surgery that would be recommended if things weren't going well, which would be a removal of the first rib.
Right, a first rib resection. Yes.
Yeah. So I've never really heard you guys. I listen pretty frequently to Larry almost every day. And I don't know that I've ever heard you guys talk about thoracic outlet syndrome,
sure.
And I value your guys' opinion and just wondering what you think.
Well, thanks a lot for calling.
Right.
And what is this, Jill?
So thoracic outlet syndrome is kind of a garbage can term. As she mentioned, as Maury mentioned, there's vascular, where you actually restrict blood flow up in the clavicular region down to your hands, and then there's neurogenic, where it just is putting some pressure on your brachial plexus. So there's what I like to call the nerves and the arteries and the veins that come out of your neck and go kind of over and around your collarbone and your first rib, like Maureen mentioned, and then it actually goes under a muscle, your pec minor. That's your what I call your information superhighway to your upper extremity. And it's a tight system. It's like a big, busy highway, and there's many, many places where those structures can become impinged or entrapped or hung up. And it's classically around your first rib, in what we call your rib, your first rib and clavicular junction, or under your pec minor.
So the first rib is the one that's kind of closest to your neck.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. And there's many muscles that attach to it, and what we call elevate your first rib or pull your first rib up, and that can cause some impingement on this neurovascular structure, and you end up with numbness and tingling into your hand. It's typically into your index finger and your pinky, although it can be your entire hand. And Maury, does work make it worse?
Reaching up at work, and then I also garden, so reaching down when I'm gardening,
sure.
And then I also cook a lot, and so I know posture is part of it, too.
Posture is huge, so everything that Marit does is bringing her arms forward, and what it'll do is it'll cause some tightness in those anterior chest musculature, so posture is key. So getting your neck in a good position, making sure that there's adequate mobility throughout your ribs, your clavicle, all the soft tissue structures in the front of your upper chest area, and then you can actually do some mobilization for your nervous system. So those are the kind of interventions that you will do. And I know Lori wants to jump in here. And what I will tell you anecdotally is, based on my experience, and unfortunately I see this quite a bit in the population with which I work, It's a struggle because you try and stretch these muscles because they're tight, and when you stretch them, sometimes they actually cause a little compression on your nervous system, and then your symptoms kind of get recreated. So it's a slow process to get people better. I would definitely try conservative care before I'd go in for a first rib resection, because there's so many structures that attach to your first rib.
Right.
I'd just be a little slow to go to surgery.
Right. And you took a long time to get here. You're not going to fix it in 2 weeks. So it's going to be a long, slow process. If you go in surgically, you're going to create more scar. Uh-huh. You could potentially still have problems. So the presumption that it's a first rib problem, I don't think you can make a surgical decision on that assumption because of all the things that Jill said and all the potential generators, pain generators for this problem. So I think you need to continue to work with a physical therapist as you sort through all the different areas that could be contributing to this, as well as your current activities. And then only after a fairly extensive trial of working at this slowly, if you're still really symptomatic, then you would think about what's next.
Did you have plain films done? Did you have radiographs done at all?
No, they haven't done any of it.
Okay. So the only thing that would make me have you go to surgery a little sooner is if you have what we call cervical ribs. So occasionally people who have thoracic outlet have their transverse process on their last cervical segment grows kind of long. Like it didn't decide whether it should be part of the spine or if it should make itself a rib, and it kind of does this weird thing, and you can kind of grow out and have what we call cervical ribs. And in that case, if you have those and they feel that's where the pain generator is, to excise those, you usually have a good outcome. If you don't have those, then I would be slow to go to surgery.
There you go. Marie, good luck. Yeah, thanks so much. Let us know how everything turns out, will you? Appreciate the call very much. We have Jennifer in Milwaukee up next. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. I'm calling because I have been having some progressive pain, radiculopathy down my right leg for about the last, I would say, 4 to 6 weeks. I had an MRI done last week, and it showed a large herniated disc in my lumbar spine. Right now I'm on a course of oral prednisone, which really isn't touching the pain. I mostly have pain when I go from sitting to standing. That's when there's the shooting pain down my leg, and also sitting for a while is very uncomfortable, and also in certain positions that I lay. My doctor has referred me to start some physical therapy. I'm really hoping to avoid cortisone injections or surgery. I'm just wondering the opinion of the speakers as far as kind of what physical therapy I should be, or I guess what I should be talking to the physical therapist about doing for me. I had done a couple of sessions a few weeks ago, and it was not effective, and I'm just wondering if there's any recommendations on special physical therapy techniques for herniated discs or how I can...
Sure. First of all, I would, you have to give this time. So you herniated a disc. The discs are under constant compression. They're under constant load when you are in a vertical position, whether you're standing or sitting. So you think if you have an open wound or a cut on your hand, if you're constantly pulling the ends of those wound apart, it's really hard for it to heal. The same is true for the herniated disc. When you're under a gravitational load, it takes time for this to heal. So the physical therapist should be working with you on positioning in ways that decrease your pain, which are ways to help the herniation resorb. So, you know, we use some exercises in flexion. We use some extension. It depends upon your response to it. So typically we want to get to extension exercises, or what they call McKenzie exercises, but you often can't start there because the herniation is either too large or too acute. So it takes a little bit of trial and error with physical therapy to figure out where is the right place to start, and then you have to give it time. We see this every day. We see people with acute disc herniations every day, and you can get better, but you have to be patient, and you have to really follow their advice. if you felt like the first, like you weren't getting where you wanted to go with the first physical therapist, you can try someone else. I would look for someone who is an orthopedic clinical specialist, because they are people who have additional credentials in treating these kinds of injuries. In the Milwaukee area, you should be easily find somebody there who's an orthopedic clinical specialist.
Right. As a general rule, what we want is we want your symptoms to what we call centralize or get closer to your back, not peripheralize or go down your legs. So if there's a certain position you find where the symptoms go out of your leg and come back up towards your buttocks or your back, that is the directional preference or the preferred preference for you. And it'd be helpful for you to make note of that so you can report that back when you go back to see your physical therapist. I feel better, or my leg symptoms subside when I'm in such and such position. That can help guide what's going to work best for you.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Lucy emailed to say she's 27 and has noticed she's getting a hump at the base of her neck. 27. She has poor posture, rounding her shoulders. If she works on maintaining good posture, will the hump go away, or what other options are there?
So it's probably right where her cervical spine and her thoracic spine come together, your CT junction. And if she does have poor posture and her head is forward, that will make that hump more obvious. So getting on a program to fix her posture and pull her head and neck back would be really important. It would probably be worth Lucy seeing a physical therapist for 1 to 2 visits to get on a good program to prevent this from getting progressively worse.
Right. There are lots of things we do, a lot of upper back and thoracic spine things. I like to use a pool noodle underneath your thoracic spine to work on extending that, and then tucking your chin and doing a little bit of cervical work with that. And a physical therapist can give you a set of exercises that you can do at home as part of a program to maintain good posture, opening up your chest, strengthening your upper back and neck muscles.
Judy in Oak Creek, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I am speaking from somebody who's had multiple joint replacements on one side of my body, and the reason I'm calling is I wanted to put a cautionary note in there. Sometimes if you wait too long to have one joint or surgery done, it can and does impact other joints. And I started with my hip, went to my knee, went to my ankle, and I just think that's important for people to know.
Yeah.
That's a great point. Once you start, you know, having significant changes or alterations in your gait pattern when you're walking, and you change how you load those other joints, it can actually accelerate the arthritic process in those other joints. So Judy brings up a really good point that you don't want it to be impacting other joints.
Right. That's a point we've made throughout the show, particularly with the people who have lost full knee extension or are changing how they walk and move because of, you know, ACL deficiency or loss of knee extension or whatever. We've mentioned it affects your ankle, it affects your hip, it affects your back. So that's why it's important to start early, check in with the specialists, and make sure that the timing is right so that you don't end up with a half a dozen joint replacements.
Right. That's great. That's a great, great piece of advice.
Thank you, Judy. Appreciate it. Ken in Middleton, your turn. Hi, Ken.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call. I know you guys are swamped with calls, so...
Well, what can we do for you?
Well, I have just a comment about physical therapy that might help others, just in viewing it in a different way. I had rotator cuff surgery on both of my shoulders about 5 years ago, and some of the pain came back in one of the shoulders. I'm very physical, very active. And when I've thought about physical therapy, I've always thought of it just in terms of exercise. And I saw a physical therapist recently that's helped me immensely. Yes, he gave me exercises, but he also did adjustments or a manipulation on the shoulder, which opens it up. It's not a manipulation like a chiropractor, but it's more of a gentle, manipulation that opened it.
And like a joint mobilization kind of thing?
Yes.
Yeah.
I guess. And again, I just never thought of physical therapy in that regard. And again, this kind of hands-on approach has really helped me.
Oh, that's excellent.
That's great. Yeah. Manual therapy, there's more and more evidence showing that manual therapy or doing those things that where therapists manually move your joints as we know they're supposed to move when you actively do it, has come into the research lately showing that it is very effective.
I've seen a number of people with hip joint arthritis who have lost motion in their hip, and it's very difficult because of the tightness of the hip joint capsule to stretch that joint when people have arthritic hips. It just hurts. But a physical therapist can get in there and mobilize the joint. They use their body weight. They use large straps, et cetera, to gap the joint and stretch the capsule, and it really helps increase their range of motion.
Right.
So, yes, manual therapy is a big part of physical therapist practice.
Ken, thank you very much. And speaking of the hip joint, John in Madison has something for us. Hi, John.
Hi. Well, that's really great timing because it is part of my question. I've had hip problems since I was in high school playing football, kind of a click in my right hip joint. And then as an adult, I'm 57 now, 10 years ago, I had an MRI done, and the doctor and the radiologist were conflicted about, do I really have arthritis? It was so slight, you know, they really couldn't agree. So I went to a chiropractor, and she did some of that, what we call mobilization, which helped tremendously. And what was fascinating later is I started, because I couldn't run anymore. I just couldn't pound anymore. So I got on my bike. And he told me this, but exercising on my bike was tremendous, and now I can walk distances again. So I just wanted to throw that comment in there. I think I'm too early for a hip replacement, but I just wanted to
Yeah. That's a great story, John, and you're absolutely right. So getting the hip joint moving through mobilization, and there's some that the physical therapist can do. In your case, the chiropractor did it. Not a manipulation, but a mobilization. And then they can also teach you ways to mobilize that joint at home, and then to follow that with an exercise that's non-impactful, but that continuous movement that lubricates the joint surface and keeps those tissues pliable and flexible. That's perfect.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
Great. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Vicki in Madison, your turn. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to hang up because I have somebody that just came.
Very good. Well, we're running out of time. Carol, do you have a quick comment from Nina?
Opinion. People should think very, very, very carefully about having any kind of hip replacements, knee replacements, whatever, ankle replacements, whatever, until they lose weight. Anything in excess of 30 pounds overweight, very, very, very difficult to recover. My joints and my fingers were ruined by arthritis because I had to hold on to the walker in order to recover from my hip replacement. Now I need to have my finger joints replaced. So my caution.
Yeah,
and there are many physicians out there who they pay very close attention to their patient's BMI or body mass index and do want to make sure that the patient isn't excessively overweight prior to doing a joint replacement. So many physicians will kind of screen for that.
I often see patients who have, for example, severe knee arthritis and need a knee replacement, but they have to lose weight.
Right.
So they come to physical therapy and I take them in the pool and get them going on a program to strengthen and to lose weight.
It's great.
Well, on that note, we are about out of time. And Jill and Lori, you will be back on July 16th, and we'll do this all over again.
Perfect.
Sounds great.
Right before our bike trip.
That's right.
Just before.
Just before.
Lori Tyne-Brody and Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, our guest, Lori, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. They'll be back. We will talk with them again on July 16th. Tomorrow at 11, we'll talk to the author of a new book that tells the story of her friendship with a Tibetan refugee family. Join us for that. And then at 11:45, we talk about emotions. How can we interpret them and what they mean? In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store.